From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In Oakland this week, a group of high school students went to see the movie Schindler's List. It's a film about the horrors of the Holocaust, and that's what their teacher said they wanted the students to learn.
At one point in the movie, there was a very graphic execution scene, which prompted laughter from the students. That, in turn, prompted dozens of patrons to leave their seats, upset and complaining.
The stormy and complex relationship between blacks and Jews. An investigation of a major prison riot that took place in New York 2 weeks ago. Was it caused by overcrowding or abuse by prison guards? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Congressional Republicans and the Clinton administration have agreed on how to balance the budget for the first time in nearly three decades. Congress is likely to approve the plan this week. Among its highlights are a $400 to $500 per child tax credit, significant cuts in capital gains and inheritance taxes, $1,500 scholarships for each of the first 2 years of college for middle-income students, and $24 billion for children's health care. On the issue of capital gains, the White House gave Republicans even more than they'd been asking for. Profits from sales of investments held for 5 years or more would be taxed at only 18%, below the 20% they had sought. Studies long stored at the Pentagon's archives show that tens of thousands of American soldiers were killed or maimed in the Vietnam and Korean wars by American-made landmines. This according to a report by groups seeking American support for an international moratorium on the weapons. The report, based on a review of a 15-volume set of Army documents on mine warfare, suggests that American-made mines have often been as great a threat to American soldiers as to the enemy. The authors from the Human Rights Watch Arms Project, a Washington-based arms control group, and the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation said the report demonstrated the need for the Clinton administration to abandon its claim that landmines safeguard the lives of American troops. According to the report, Army research shows that nearly 90% of the mines and booby traps used against American troops in Vietnam were either American-made or were manufactured by enemy troops with captured American components. About 64,000 American troops were killed or injured by mines in the Vietnam War. Atmospheric nuclear bomb tests in Nevada from 1951 to 1962 exposed millions of American children to a large amounts of radioactive iodine, a component of fallout that can affect the thyroid gland. This, according to the National Cancer Institute. The releases were larger than earlier estimates and at least 10 times larger than those caused by the 1986 explosion at the Chernobyl nuclear plant in Ukraine. Under federal rules implemented in 1992 to deal with accidents at nuclear power plants, some of the tests would require protective actions like moving cows to shelter or dumping their milk that would tend to have high concentrations of radioactive iodine. But no such precautions were taken at the time of the Nevada tests. The Cancer Institute could not say whether any cases of thyroid cancer were caused by the fallout, but several experts said the levels of exposure could justify special monitoring for some people, particularly those who were children in the 1950s and 60s. North America's largest glacier is melting fast, and scientists say global warming linked to the use of fossil fuels may be to blame. This according to Greenpeace International. The Bering Glacier in Alaska has shrunk by up to 7.4 miles in length during the past century, losing some 50 square miles in surface area. The glacier retreat was documented on a recent Greenpeace expedition, which collated findings by U.S. scientists working on the site. The Reverend Joseph Lowry, considered the dean of the civil rights movement, is resigning after 20 years as leader of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Lowry guided the SCLC on a new course that embraced more mainstream social and economic policies and restored its financial stability. Lowry said he'll stay on for at least 90 days. This international news, the family of Nigerian democracy activist Bikoran Sankuti called yesterday for his release 2 years after the military government jailed him for taking part in an alleged coup plot. Nike Ransom Kute, the daughter said, "My father is physically all right, although he has fragile frame. He's in solitary confinement. He doesn't have access to lawyers." Ransom Kuti, a medical doctor, is serving a 15-year sentence for allegedly taking part in a plot to overthrow the military ruler, General Sunny Abacha, in March of 1995. Former head of state, retired General Obasanjo, and over 40 others are also serving jail sentences related to the plot, which the government has not shown any evidence for. Canada is considering imposing new trade restrictions on Burma to press its rulers to talk to pro-democracy activists. This according to an official spokesperson yesterday. She said Canada felt it had a relationship with China, with which it practices a policy it calls engagement in trade, and was hopeful of improvements there. Canada has already suspended aid to Burma and offers no government support for trade with that country. Burma last week joined the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which rejected the idea of trade or investment bans in favor of dialogue. And Britain's new Labour government is fulfilling its election promise to ban arms sales to countries with poor human rights records that might use them for internal repression. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 2 weeks ago, in Rome, New York, about 183 miles northwest of New York City, hundreds of guards from prisons across the state were forced to respond to what appears to have been a major prison riot involving hundreds of prisoners who for a while controlled the prison. State correction officials have downplayed the incident. They've released very few details of what happened at the Mohawk Correctional Institution, a prison that houses about 1,300 inmates. Some of the state's top Republicans have cited the disturbance as proof that New York should expand its prison system by building at least three more maximum security prisons. However, an investigation by Jose Santiago, news director at Pacifica Station WBAI, he's found that the clash at Mohawk Prison seems to have been sparked by longstanding physical abuse of prisoners and not by overcrowding, as some elected officials would like the public to believe. Welcome to Democracy Now!,
hey,
Jose.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, tell us what happened at this prison 2 weeks ago.
Well, there are a couple of versions. The state is saying that, yes, there was a riot, they're saying, and that it involved, they've said, several hundred inmates and also several hundred correction officers, the correction officers that are assigned to that prison and others that came from other prisons. They said that they were fairly effectively suppressed this disturbance, that they were able to contain it and get everyone back into their housing units. And they have only released, have only told us, told the public that 10 guards were injured, but they have released no information as to how many inmates were injured. And as recently as yesterday, this happened Friday, July 18, as recently as yesterday, I spoke with the correction officials, and they're still saying practically nothing. They're saying that they can't comment while the investigation of the incident is continuing. Now, what has happened is that the state right now, the state budget is overdue by about 120 days. They're still negotiating it up in Albany, the capital of New York State. And one of the final obstacles is this debate over whether or not the state should go ahead and build all these extra prisons. Governor Pataki wants to spend $650 million to build 7,000 more maximum security cells over the next 5 years. And his opponents on the Democratic side have been fighting this, and they're trying to negotiate a smaller number of cells to be built, and then returning some of the programs that have been cut back, such as drug rehab programs for inmates. They're feeling that the state doesn't need to expand its prison system. So what happened right after this this riot was that state Republicans began showing up at the prison and started saying, "This is why we need more prisons, because overcrowding caused this." Hmm. But our sources, and we have some very extremely reliable sources within the prison system, and a number of inmates who we've spoken with who have just come out of Mohawk, that particular facility, are saying that overcrowding had nothing to do with it. There was a tremendous wave of abuse on the part of prison guards in the weeks preceding this uprising, this explosion, really. Their feeling is that overcrowding has nothing to do with it, that this was something that was really triggered by excessive abuse on the part of guards going back a long time, culminating, they say, in an alleged suicide of an inmate on Thursday, the Thursday before this riot, this disturbance took place. And they are raising a lot of questions about this suicide because they say it was very mysterious. It was very unlikely that this this inmate in the box in a solitary confinement unit was would be able to hang himself, as prison officials are saying.
You know, I think it's very significant to find out about this riot and about prison conditions because, as we've reported before, it's tough for journalists to get inside prisons. I mean, increasingly, state by state, they're not allowing journalists in for face-to-face interviews with prisoners, and also this whole issue of prisons, building prisons. California's second most powerful lobby group is the California Prison Guards Association. And the issue of riots, it's often hard to know that something has taken place. We just learned yesterday there was a prison uprising in Arkansas as well.
Yeah. It used to be, and I've covered prison issues going back many years, and it used to be that you had some access. You never had great access, but now it's the doors are closed, and the information is really, they're just sitting on it. They're not releasing anything. A lot of parents have been calling us, a lot of family members, relatives of inmates, and advocacy groups that want to go up to visit have been denied access. There was a group of ministers in Rome itself, right in the vicinity, who wanted to meet with prison officials. They were denied. There's a group in New York City that has been organizing some of the parents. They want to go up. They've been told that they can't go up there until after the middle of August sometime, which is past the date when the official investigation is supposed to be completed.
Well, speaking of parents, Jose, you recorded a mother reading a letter from her son in prison.
Yeah, we just want to give you a sense of what the human toll of this is. One of the points I didn't mention that I think we should mention before we go to the mother of an inmate is that one of the charges that has surfaced is that the inmates are saying that there's one particular group of extremely abusive guards who wear this very distinctive tattoo, and the tattoo, they say, depicts a black child, a black baby with a noose around its neck. And this is a tattoo that has surfaced in the last 2 or 3 years in the New York State prison system. A lot of people are wondering, is this some sort of a brotherhood of guards? And in every facility where we've heard about this tattoo, those guards seem to be the most abusive. In the days following, a couple of days after this uprising at Mohawk Prison, we were able to speak to the mother of one of the inmates who received the letter from her son. We cannot reveal the her name or her son's name because they're afraid that something might happen to him up there. They find out that he's been talking to people. Here is the mother of an inmate reading from a letter she received from her son, in which he describes what happened at the facility.
This is Dear Mommy. I hope and pray that upon the arrival of this letter, you and the rest of the family are in the very best of God's guidance. As for myself, trying hard to stay with a clear... I'm going to put my daughter to read it.
And she was clearly very distraught. She was not able to continue, but she asked her daughter to continue reading the letter. And in it, the young man describes a situation where he says at times as many as 500, 600, 700 inmates were clashing with as many as 100 or more guards who came in. They had this big battle where inmates used barbells and baseball bats to defend themselves. This went on for some time. And he said in his letter that at one point, point, they actually controlled the prison. And our sources tell us that although the state is trying to say that what happened there was quelled very quickly and wasn't that serious, our sources tell us that the inmates at one point controlled the facility and were actually in negotiations with administrators, a la what happened in Attica in 1971. They were trying to get negotiate being able to make a phone call to call the press, but they were not allowed to do that. They were subdued with tear gas and returned to their cells. But let's continue with the daughter of an inmate reading from a letter from that inmate.
On Thursday the 17th, an inmate supposedly hung himself in the box. That's what they call solitary confinement. As it turns out, no one believes this story, Mommy. It is almost practically impossible for anyone to hang themselves in the box, in that box. By this happening, a lot of people flipped out and got truly fed up with everything that's been going on in here. People are tired of all the constant police brutality, all the physical abuse, and all the psychological torture. People are tired of the way these officers abuse their authority, and people are tired of what the aggressive, unnecessary, tired of all the aggressive, unnecessary behavior that they treat us with. On Friday afternoon, the day after the kid hung himself, I and about 100 other people witnessed an officer actually hit someone so hard in the back of his head that he knocked him out, and he was already handcuffed. Then, at about 6 p.m., when recreation was being called and everyone was going to the yard, an officer pulled somebody over. They exchange a few words, and the officer begins beating him down. After all that has happened, that was the wrong thing to do in front of 300 inmates.
And the letter went on to describe the brawl, the battle that ensued. It went deep into the night, into the next morning. Again, a lot of correction guards from other facilities showed up at the facility. They were able to quell it using tear gas. But there are still many questions about the whole issue of what sparked it. Was it overcrowding, or was it the abuse that inmates say that they're suffering at the hands of guards? We have spoken with a former Mohawk inmate, a gentleman by the name of Richard White, who, when he was at Mohawk, was a liaison between the inmates and the administration. And he also is someone who spent time in that segregation unit, the so-called box, where the young man allegedly committed suicide. And he spoke with us about the box and his experience at Mohawk Prison.
This is not the first time this occurred. There was a similar incident in 1993, where an inmate had supposedly hung himself in his special housing unit cell. Now, due to the fact that I have served time in one of those exact cells there in special housing unit, I know for a fact that it is virtually impossible for an inmate to commit suicide by using a sheet, because there's nothing on which to tie one end of the sheet while tying the other end around the inmate's neck. It's just impossible.
And that's Richard White, who spent time in that box, and he is echoing the sentiments of many inmates and former inmates and parents of inmates who have contacted us, who feel that this really needs to be investigated. But again, hardly anything is happening in terms of, there is an investigation going on, but we're not hearing very much at all, in fact, nothing at all about the investigation, as long as these budget negotiations are going on. And we want to play one last cut of a longtime prison prisoners' rights advocate, Eddie Ellis, who I think has been heard on the Democracy Now! Before. He's someone who is former Black Panther, served many years in prison, and is very familiar with issues affecting inmates. And he spoke about that tattoo and how it surfaced in the last couple of years and what people are feeling about that particular tattoo.
We've been getting reports over the last 2 or 3 years of officers who have have these tattoos with black babies, with a rope around a black baby's neck, and it seems to be some badge or some mark of perhaps a covert organization that's been organizing in the prison system. We do know for a fact that over a decade and a half ago, there were confirmed reports of officers who were members of the Ku Klux Klan and other right-wing extremist racist groups. And as you may be aware, there was a major challenge made to the fact that the officers were members of these groups and working in prisons that were predominantly populated by blacks and Latinos. And as it turned out, the officers' union prevailed in court, and the court order essentially said that they were protected by the First Amendment and that they could belong to any organization that they wanted, as long as that did not impact in any negative way on the way in which they performed their duties while on, while in the service of the Department of Corrections.
So while it seems that the guards are allowed to wear this tattoo, there are many questions as to whether they should be wearing a tattoo in a population that in many cases is predominantly black. And here they are wearing a tattoo with a black child with a noose around its neck. There are many questions as to how effectively the Corrections Department has monitored these guards, who inmates say are very abusive. There is one state Democrat and whose name we can't reveal, has begun an investigation. He's looking into this. We probably will hear more about this in the future. And a lot of prison advocacy groups are wanting to get to the prison to talk to people there, and especially to get the story that the inmates so far have not been able to tell.
Well, Jose, it certainly sounds like there should be state hearings on what's going on inside this prison, and I would assume that it's going on in other prisons in New York State, not to mention congressional hearings.
That's another point. Since we've began airing these stories last week, we've gotten letters and communications from parents of inmates in other facilities, and there appears to have been another similar suicide in the same day at another prison, in fact, at Attica, so we're looking into that as well.
Well, Jose Santiago, I want to thank you very much for this report. Jose is the news director at Pacifica Station WBAI here in New York. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Tonight on the PBS Showcase for independent nonfiction film called POV, which stands for Point of View, they're going to be airing a documentary called Blacks and Jews, which explores the shared history and roots of conflict between the two communities. Heading an African-American and Jewish production team, filmmakers Deborah Kaufman, Barry Scott, and Alan Snitow go beyond the stereotypes and explosive headlines to reveal four riveting stories that tread on the fault lines of racial coalition and conflict. From death on the streets of Crown Heights, New York, to director Steven Spielberg's controversial visit to a predominantly black high school in East Oakland, California, Blacks and Jews takes on these issues and hears voices of people in different communities. We're going to start with Barry Scott. I should also say Barry Scott and Alan Snitow hail from KPFA. Alan, years ago, was the news director at KPFA, Pacifica Station in Berkeley, California. Barry Scott continues to be a producer at KPFA. Barry, why don't you tell us about the Crown Heights story and the take that you took on it in your film, Blacks and Jews?
First, Amy, I wanted to just talk briefly about, before we sort of get into that, why I was involved in this project. Because of just personal involvement with the whole issue of accusations back and forth between the two communities, just sort of on a personal level, of charges of anti-Semitism, charges of racism. And what I found is that it began to, and what I noticed is that it began to affect what issues people were actually talking about. It stopped the flow of progressive thinking or progressive discussion. No one was talking about issues of social justice. No one was talking about, you know, quote, fighting the good fight. Everyone was only talking about who is more racist than the other. And perhaps there were reasons for that, but at some point it clouded what I thought we should really be trying to address. And so when the opportunity came to try to deal with the issues as best as we could head on, or to at least try to face some of it, then I thought it was a good opportunity to do so and to be part of the project, and to also look to see what issues existed for me, what questions existed for me, what questions that Deborah and Alan may have to represent, and how can we attempt to look at some of those issues and still be friends and still try to remember that there is a bigger picture out there about survival, about care, about trying to identify who some of the real enemies are. So Crown Heights became a jumping off point, because that was the term that's used in the film, a pogrom that illustrated in a way some of the angers and some of the issues. In the past it had been words that people had used. Here were two communities who were actually hitting on each other in a physical way, throwing rocks at each other. So that was a good place to start. August 1991, relations between the black and Jewish communities hit bottom as neighbor fought neighbor on the streets of Crown Heights in Brooklyn, New York.
Some friends came by and said, look, you know, Crown Heights is jumping.
Village Voice reporter Peter Noel.
A kid was hit by a Jew, as they say, and there's a riot going on.
Crown Heights was like an armed camp. There were police all over the place, on every corner of an intersection, not just on one corner, on every corner, four corners. Riot gear, shields, clubs, tear gas, shotguns, cops on Harleys, on horseback, in helicopters flying overhead. It was an armed camp.
But the police did not help Isaac Beaton and his son.
I saved him, and I didn't. I'm not trying to be a hero for that. I was trying to just hold him and try to get him away from the crowd. And people were shouting. A woman was shouting, "Die, bitch, die!" And you know, people, sticks and stones were just coming from everywhere.
Huh? We fought down.
I just saw another human being who was not part. He was not a soldier in this combat. He was just a victim. Well, he was Jewish, yes. But he was a victim. He was not a part of the combat that was happening at that point in time, and I couldn't see him just go down like that. I was not a soldier in this war either. I was just observing this war and recording this war. You know. The next day, there's a photo of this man lying prostrate on the sidewalk, splashed across the front page of the New York Post. It showed then black people's inhumanity toward Jews. I'm saying, wait a minute. Where is the photo of me trying to help this man? And for a couple months, you know, I just thought about it and never really tried to get in touch with the man, Isaac Beaton, until one day we made plans to meet.
And you ended up focusing on, among other people, in the Crown Heights story, Peter Noel, an African-American journalist who wrote about the riots, but also was involved with them in a particular way, and the Hasidic man who he did not know before the riots. Deborah, can you talk a little about why you chose these two men?
Well, it's an incredible story because it really undermines, I think, the media stereotype of kind of one-dimensionality in terms of what was going on during those days in Crown Heights. Peter Noel was a journalist covering the uprising, riot, pogrom, depending on your point of view, as we say in the film, for the Village Voice when he came upon a Hasidic man who was being attacked on the street, and he did save this man's life, Isaac Bitton. The story that's told in the film is of an image in the New York Post of the Hasidic man down on the ground as a victim, kind of traditional image of a victim on this Jewish victim on the street. Peter asks himself, Bette also asks us in the film, you know, why wasn't there a picture of me trying to help this man? I mean, the media coverage is kind of a subplot of our film, having to do with outsiders wanting to use conflict basically as a way of both defining our relationship to each other, but also obviously mainstream media is using conflict as a way to make money because it sells. So we were trying to tell a story in which a participant in the struggle had a very clear picture, really, of the manipulation of the media and also of his own role in crossing borders. I mean, he went out there and saved this man's life, and it's a great story. They got together afterwards and became friends, and their relationship is depicted to the extent that we could in a 90-minute film, and that's episodic and tells various stories. Tried to give a glimpse of the fact that people do cross borders. We aren't all in our respective ghettos. In fact, that there's a lot of intermingling between lots of different people.
In the film, you also talk about the breakdown of relations in terms of overall generalization, but between the Black and Jewish communities. Going back to the 1960s, you talk about the communities working together, but then there being a breaking point. Alan Snitow, what do you think that breaking point was?
Well, I think that every community has myths about its own history, often romanticized. And I know that coming from the Jewish community, a lot of times we felt and have experienced it as being that Jews were deeply involved in the Civil Rights Coalition, and that and many people say, well, Jews were thrown out in SNCC and CORE and other organizations, and all whites were thrown out. That is one aspect of the history, but it has become a substitute for a lot of other things that were going on at the time. And I think that very often in the Jewish community, Jews don't want to look at some of those other things. And so one of the stories that we tell in the film about the community of Lawndale in the west side of Chicago, it was one of the largest Jewish communities in the country in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And then in a space of about 10 years, about 80,000 Jews moved out and 80,000 African Americans moved in. And part of this story is about the end of the coalition. And what we found is that really the agendas of the two communities were diverging, and that Jews were moving to the suburbs. And on top of that, that very often when the civil rights movement coalition moved north, it challenged more entrenched economic interests in white communities. And the rabbi and the priest and the minister, who were leaders of the white coalition part that was supporting the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King in Chicago, they were all driven out of the city as a result of their stands on civil rights in the city of Chicago itself. So in other words, the movement moving north divided these constituencies, which when it was south, it was easier to support civil rights. And so this is a different route to the end of coalition than I think many people want to think about. They want to think about, oh, well, we were pushed out. But actually, there were deep divisions within the community. And that then leads us to a lot of the direction that we talk about, which is that the decision on coalition comes from inside communities. It's not something that's generated from without, that one community is so deeply involved or identifies with another community. But it actually has to do with need, but also with leadership. And so we wanted to pose that as an issue and as also another reason why that coalition seemed to come to an end in the late 60s, early 70s.
That story that you tell in Chicago is one that I didn't know about. The Contract Buyers League and the Jews, particularly this Rabbi Marx, who came in and understood what was happening and where the tension was coming from. Can you tell that story very briefly?
Blacks moved largely from the south to the south side of Chicago, and then when it sort of opened up because of redlining and so on, blacks could move into this particular neighborhood. They would be very often blacks were killed or attacked if they went into other ethnic neighborhoods. The movement into this area of Lawndale permitted blockbusting. I drive by real estate speculators to force people in the area, whites, and in this area obviously it was mostly Jews, to sell cheap and then to sell very, very high to blacks moving in who were desperate for housing. And the result was that you had enormous profit gouging there, but the next point was that the banks refused to make loans to black home buyers. And just across the board, but they would make loans to real estate speculators. So the real estate speculators, who were the ones who were getting cheap houses, selling high, were the ones who got the loan money, and what they would give to the black home buyer was called a contract, and it meant no equity. If you missed a single payment, even if you'd lived in that house and paid every month for 20 years, you could be thrown out and evicted immediately. So this was literally the combination of the block busting and the contract was a race tax. And there was a huge movement that developed in Chicago against this situation. And Rabbi Marx had been, and his organization, the Jewish Council on Urban Affairs, had been working with activists in Lawndale area and black activists in the area for some years. And they supported the Contract Buyers League in their battle with the real estate speculators. And the speculators were very tied into extremely powerful interests in City Hall, Mayor Daley in Chicago, and forced the eviction of many, many of these home buyers. And so there were really pitched battles. Hundreds of people were evicted. It was an intense struggle and extremely well covered in Chicago, but no one remembers it. It's like it's as if it were a part of our history which is entirely forgotten, been thrown under the rug. People know that Martin Luther King went to Chicago, but the fact that there was this huge movement in the city and in many other places in the North that this kind of pattern was reproduced has been left out of history.
Alan Snitow, Barry Scott, and Deborah Kaufman, let's go to a part of Blacks and Jews where you describe this controversy in Chicago.
How much possession does a person need? How much land does a person need?
Rabbi Robert Marx was angry when he found that Jewish real estate agents also played a role in ghettoizing Lawndale. Since Lawndale had been a Jewish community for 50 years, many real estate agents in the area were Jewish. Some of them deliberately frightened Jewish residents into selling their homes.
They were exploiting. But they were exploiting Jews and blacks, and that has to be remembered. They were going to Jewish homes and say, you better get out because the neighborhood is changing. They bought homes at much less than they were worth. They turned around and sold them at much more than they were worth. They were a group of people that we fought with all of our vigor.
Rabbi Marx took on powerful interests in his own community. In the late 1960s, it was not black people against Jews, but a division within the Jewish community itself.
The rest of the Jewish community, and this is the painful part, never understood, I think, the implications of this struggle. The rest of the Jewish community did not help us. And I feel this, I must confess, it's almost a personal failure that lives with me today, that I could never explain more clearly the moral dimensions of what I saw was going on.
Inspired by Martin Luther King, a new grassroots movement emerged in Lawndale, pitting black homebuyers against real estate speculators.
There are blocks like this scattered throughout the Lawndale section of Chicago's West Side ghetto. The people who live here bought their homes from real estate speculators at double or triple their value, and they bought on contract because they couldn't get conventional or FHA mortgages. Under the contract, the buyer makes installment payments at high interest, but he builds no equity. If he defaults on even one payment at any time during the contract, he loses the property and everything he's paid into it.
No one yet has looked at the role of the banks and the insurance companies. And before you talk about a Jewish role, you have to understand the behind-the-scenes role of the non-Jewish banks and the insurance companies who were involved in this. The banks were perfectly willing to put money in the hands of these white sellers, but were not willing to lend money to the black buyers. So the white sellers, in this case, the Jewish white sellers, were the servants of the large banks.
You're paying 10th interest on $10,000 more than you should be paying at the rate of 7% a year.
Supported by white civil rights activists, the Lawndale homebuyers organized the Contract Buyers League, which spread quickly across black Chicago.
This is getting up like telling that you have found the Lord. It's such a burden off you. You can't keep it to yourselves. You like to tell everybody about it.
It was just like a revival of some kind, you know. You see people coming all through the neighborhoods coming out to the meeting. Sometimes we have as high as 200, 300 people at a meeting. And we would have prayer and singing and speech making.
These people who have cheated us out of more than money, we have been cheated out of the right to be human beings.
You're listening to the excerpt of the documentary Blacks and Jews, which will air tonight on PBS on POV, which is the Independent Nonfiction Film Forum on PBS. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're going to continue our conversation with the filmmakers of Blacks and Jews, Deborah Kaufman, Barry Scott, and Alan Snitow. In addition to the Chicago and Crown Heights stories, you tell the story of Louis Farrakhan and the reaction of Jews and Blacks to this Chicago leader. Barry Scott, you use Salim Wakil to tell the story. He used to be the co-host on Democracy Now! He was a member of the Nation of Islam, and then he left it. Tell us about this segment on Blacks and Jews.
The Farrakhan thing for me was sort of a sensitive issue, a sensitive area, for several reasons, Amy. One had to do with the fact that too often in the black-Jewish discussion, debate, it centers around Farrakhan. And there's so much that African Americans need to talk about among ourselves and with whomever else is willing to talk that has nothing to do with Louis Farrakhan. And so for that to be the point of entry for all discussion, to me, was I was concerned that the film not fall into that trap. And I think Deborah and Alan also were concerned about not doing the expected and that this film being about Louis Farrakhan. On the other hand, in the film, and this is from the African-American perspective, Let me just say two things real quick. One of the things that we try to do is, on one hand, many African Americans may have one opinion about Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. Much of it is positive, and for some people, don't understand it. Don't understand because of their Christian background or what have you, Muslims or Islam, or certainly what they may see as a spinoff group and not really Islamic. You know, I mean, that's kind of the range of that. On the other hand, there are people in the Jewish community who think that the Nation of Islam and Minister Farrakhan represent probably the epitome of danger, endangerment, anti-Semitism, etc., which from the black point of view, we don't get, we don't understand, and get off of it. And so at some point, if one of the things that you want to do is to begin to hear, well, what is it about, you know, my issues that are codes for me, that when I hear this send me up through the roof? What is it about your background and culture that if you hear certain code words send you through the roof that I may not get? Then as a person who cares about certain people and my friends, I need to know these things. We need to know these things about each other. So having said that, it was impossible to do a film about blacks and Jews without talking about or bringing up Farrakhan. The point was, how was it going to be brought up so that we didn't fall into the trap of the film being about that, you know? And so that was the route it was taken, showing people who became members of the Nation of Islam because of real progressive ideas, because of concern about their own communities, because of wanting to do good for their own communities, et cetera. As well as the whole notion, which gets into a bigger picture, I think, about African Americans in general within the context of the United States, is who tells you who you should listen to, what you should think, and what you should say about it. And for us, that becomes code for control. Even if the person who is speaking is not necessarily saying the words that you agree with, it gets back into that sort of mental code thing. We're not getting back into a slave master thing. You cannot tell me what to say or any of that.
Oh, I just wanted to add on that note that we're trying to talk about various leaders in both communities in terms of what we call a ritual. And, you know, a ritual of recriminations. It may start with one leader making an anti-Semitic comment and then a Jewish leader then demanding that there be, you know, repudiation of that statement from other African-American leaders. And this ritual enables leaders, and sometimes marginal leaders, it enables them to get promotion, national press coverage, assume a kind of dominance within their own communities. The Jewish community, it allows for fundraising on the basis of fears of anti-Semitism. I mean, there's all kinds of complicating factors, but a lot of the prominence of various figures in each community has to do with leadership struggles inside those communities and the use of the media in a kind of a ritual format to further conflict rather than, as we were talking about before, trying to identify points on which we can agree in order to further social justice or agendas that we both, our communities both need in this country. As minority groups, we can't actually, you know, further ourselves unless we are working in unison with others. So it's trying to look at forms of leadership in terms of a ritual.
We're talking to Deborah Kaufman, Barry Scott, and Alan Snitow, the producers of Blacks and Jews, which will air on POV on PBS tonight at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time around the country. In the last segment of the show, you deal with the media feeding frenzy that erupted in 1994 when students at East Oakland's Castlemont High School laughed at a showing of Steven Spielberg's Holocaust epic, Schindler's List.
Schulter, here, on my authority.
It will take more than that.
I'm sure you're right.
After that film and after the students were thrown out, as you say in the film, there was a media feeding frenzy.
Coming up on the Night Beat, high school students thrown out of a screening of Schindler's List say they'll go back.
In Oakland this week, a group of high school students went to see the movie Schindler's List.
Deborah,
it's a film about the horrors of the Holocaust, and that's what their teacher said they wanted the students to learn.
At one point in the movie, there was a very graphic scene, which prompted laughter from the students. That, in turn, prompted dozens of patrons to leave their seats, upset and complaining.
It was a field trip that not many of those students are likely to forget, and if there's something good to come out of this story, that's it.
Deborah, can you tell us a little about what happened here and how you chose to deal with this in Blacks and Jews?
We're telling a story in the film that had to do with kids from high school in East Oakland attending a screening of Schindler's List on Martin Luther King's birthday in 1994. And during the screening, a few of them were rowdy and made noise, and some of them laughed, and they were asked to leave the theater, and it sparked a huge media cavalcade in the Bay Area that then became national and on CNN and actually international even, in which the kids became the basis of a discussion about, you know, minority kids being insensitive to violence, and it just kind of took off in a very kind of massive way. And then there were repercussions in the local community and at the school, which we follow over a period of time. Now, this happened in our backyard because we live in the East Bay in the Berkeley, Oakland area while we were making this film about Blacks and Jews, and it was inevitable that we would start covering this story from the inside. There's a lot of dimensions to the story. It's the longest story that we tell in the film, so I can't really give you all the dimensions now. But what was important was that first of all, nobody was listening to the kids throughout the coverage, so we felt very pleased to be able to actually interview some of the students themselves who either were at the theater or in the school as activists, sensitive and very aware of the media manipulation that was going on, and the manipulation by adults in the community for their own ends. There were sparking a lot of debate. Traditional stereotypes about Jews happened in the community after the screening and after the kids were thrown out of the theater. In the end, after a several-month period, Steven Spielberg came to the school with Governor Pete Wilson to teach the kids supposedly about tolerance. We try to tell the story from multiple points of view, as we do many of the stories within the film, trying to show both the Jewish perspective, Black perspective, the multiplicity of perspectives within each community, adults, kids, various community institution leaders versus just people on the street.
My favorite part was the last student who stood up when Governor Wilson and Steven Spielberg were standing before the students and who said this issue goes beyond the Black-Jewish issue and just confronted Wilson and said, really, what are you doing here? Let's take a listen.
This is to Governor Wilson. I see your visit to Oakland, a city plagued with poverty, from different views. I see it as a failing governor's publicity stunt that enables him to portray himself as a caring politician, embracing the poor and smothering them with empty promises. Coincidentally close to election time. But I also see the entire political fiasco as an opportunity to vend the anger and despite and animosity I feel toward your entire office, your entire time in office. I want to know, was your main purpose in portraying yourself through the streets of my city were to have, well, where you have cut welfare, education, and many young futures like mine?
I won't count on your vote.
To Governor Wilson saying that this really goes beyond Blacks and Jews. In fact, often the tension between African Americans and Jews is a ruse for not looking at other things.
Well, one of the things about the film was it's an effort to reframe it was an experiment, really, to reframe the issue, see if we could actually talk about things in a different way. And part of the aim in that is also for young people who are coming into things with really without the same blinkers, the same prejudices necessarily that are absolutely set in the way their elders are. And so we wanted to see if we could break free of the way this, the relationship between blacks and Jews has been talked about, while still dealing with many of the issues that and stereotypes that have come to the fore. And I think that we found that we could, not only that there are more questions, as Barry was talking about, that there are also different questions that can be asked. And at this point, my sense is that a lot of people, both in the Jewish community and the black community, are tired of the way this relationship has been framed. It's going nowhere. It is so easily a subject to demagogic appeals to people in each community. It so easily feeds into the program of to conservative programs, political programs. It so easily avoids and distracts people from real problems that exist in the society. And, you know, there are real issues between black and Jewish communities and between some Jews and some blacks. And those things are not necessarily going to be resolved, but you can also begin to talk about things that are that, that go beyond them, that also raise issues about how do you foster social change? What kind of leadership do you need? What kind of message are you going to bring to young people about the possibility of intergroup relations? Kids that we deal with on campuses around this film really feel intimidated about talking very often. And talk is not enough, but it certainly is a start. And the intimidation and the silencing that has happened because of fear is a real obstacle to the kind of political pleasure that movements can bring of learning new things, of excitement about of meeting people. And that's what we're hoping that maybe we can reframe things in that direction.
Alan, I want to end with Barry Scott just telling us the ending of that story with the student body president at the East Oakland School. I think it might shock a lot of people who didn't know about the story that she actually got in trouble for what she said to Barry, to what she said to Governor Wilson.
Well, I think the story behind that is that a couple of the kids had helped actually put that together. And she had the courage to stand up and present it. And it was a question that, I mean, I thought it was really quite brave of a young woman to stand there with perhaps 100 cameras or 100 media representatives to ask the governor, you know, why are you here? And, I mean, you, a person who is in a major way killing the hopes and dreams of young people like me, you know, harming my community. This is a school that is predominantly African-American and Latino. You know, we had, I mean, he was the leader behind the immigration bill. I mean, as a matter of fact, his failing governorship efforts were revived behind the immigration and his participation in anti-affirmative action.
We can't see it here on the radio, but he was livid when she asked this question. His face was contorting.
A lot of people were livid because people wanted to show that, you know, these inner city East Oakland kids could behave, that it would soon be over, that this would be behind us. We would have the governor, it would just be nice, nice. No one was willing to push the issue. The whole focus, so much of the focus of the media coverage were against the kids in a lot of ways. I mean, and this was another example, and many people I know who called me on the phone, African Americans who called me on the phone phrased it, now they're going after our kids. And that's how people in the black community saw, now they're going after our kids.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Barry Scott, Deborah Kaufman, and Alan Snitow for joining us on this morning before tonight's airing of your documentary, Blacks and Jews. It airs on PBS on POV at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we'd love to hear what you think of the documentary. Why don't you give us a call on our number and we'll air some of the comments on Blacks and Jews and also on the show today and other topics you'd like to hear discussed on Democracy Now. You can call us at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. You can also write to us by email. You can reach us at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Or you can write to us and send us through send that letter through the mail. You can send it to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. That's Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. You can get a copy of today's show by calling the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Leslie George, Janice K. Bryant, and Fuff Vollmeyer. Thanks also to Zachary Fink. Errol Maitland is our engineer in New York, Andy York, our engineer in Washington, D.C., Julie Drizin, our executive producer. Tomorrow we'll be dealing with the campaign finance abuse hearings, which resume again today on the Hill. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!